Well, brief summary. Saul is king. More importantly, he has justified his selection as king. There were those who had great doubts about that. But what did they want a king for? To lead them out into battle. And he has done that with eminent success. A, he has crushed a troublesome foe, the Ammonites. B, he has indicated to the nation of Israel, I will protect you wherever you are. That's my job and I can do it. This leads, of course, to a demand on the part of his followers to kill those who had opposed him in the first place. And Saul says, no way, we're not going to dampen or shoddy our moment of victory with the bloodshed of our fellow Israelites. That shows sagacity, and he's on the ball. But then Samuel says, good, now we've got a consensus. Everybody agrees that you're king. Let us go to Gilgal, the place of covenant, to renew the kingship. Let's reassert your kingship so that everybody will now submit to it. But, says Samuel, whilst I'm about it, I want to set the record straight. You have unceremoniously pushed me out of office, but that was your prerogative. However, I want to make it plain to posterity, you did this not because of my inefficiency or my dishonesty. And so he makes some pledge before God that I have done nothing to deserve it. I have not been dishonest, I haven't taken bribes, I have not imposed upon you. And he makes them swear, he makes them testify for the record, I was above reproach. And they have to agree. But then Samuel proceeds to say something more. Left-hand side of the page is chapter 12, and it's verse 6. He's now going to give them a much sterner warning, and we'll see why. Vayom Shmuel, and Samuel said unto the people, Adonai, it is the Lord Asher Asa et Moshe ve et Aharon, who made Moses and Aaron, and who brought your ancestors out of Egypt. The prophets were the recorders, transmitters of the ancient traditions of Israel, and they never ceased to remind the people of those traditions because of their indebtedness to God, and he's done so here. So the Atah now hit Yatzvu, stand up on your hind paws, v'ishafata etchem lifnei Adonai, because I want to enter into litigation. I want to enter into dispute with you before the Lord. Eit kol tzidkot Adonai asher asa etchem, with regard to all those righteous acts which the Lord has done for you, v'et avotechem, and for your ancestors. And let me remind you. And this is, of course, relevant for the time of year, what the parashot we're reading. Kasher ba Yaakov Mitzrayim, when Jacob came into Egypt, Vayizako avotechem el Adonai, your ancestors cried out to the Lord, Vayishlach Adonai et Moshe et Aharon, the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, Vayotziu et avotechem Eretz Mitzrayim, and he brought your ancestors out of Egypt, Vayishivum b'makom hazeh, and he returned them to this place. This is why he's reminding them, because your ancestors had short-term memories. They chose to forget et Adonai Eloheichem, the Lord their God, so that vayimkor otam, we would translate the verb machah to sell. And of course in modern parlance you could say he sold them out. But in reality the word machah means to hand over. Only in Jewish law you do not purchase, you do not own something simply by paying money for it. So that if I wanted to sell Sylvia a book, and she gave me the money, but I still have the book, it's not yours.
Oh, really?
So where does the exchange
go? When I hand the book over to you, even if you haven't paid me, the book is yours, you owe me the money.
Possession. Glad I know that.
it's kinyan, it's acquisition.
Possession is 90% of
Well, it's, yeah.
Well, in English we say possession is 90%
law. Yes. This, of course, because it requires an act of acquisition, so I have to hand it over to you and you have to receive it from me. So, therefore, the basic meaning of the word macha is not to sell, just hand over. Mm. So therefore, he handed them over. V'yad Sisra, Sarzava Chatzor, into the hands of Sisra, the captain general of Chatzor. You're familiar with him from the story of Deborah. V'yad Pelishtim, into the hands of the Philistines, and we've still got them hanging around our neck. V'yad Melech Moab, into the hands of the king of Moab. V'yilacham Ubam, and they fought against them. And what did you do? What did your ancestors do? They suddenly remembered they had a god. V'yizeku el Adonai, and they cried out to the Lord. V'yomru, and they said, Chatanu, we have sinned. Ki azavnu et Adonai, because we've forsaken the Lord. V'na'avod et ha-Baalim v'et ha-Ashtarot, and we worship the Baalim and their female consorts. V'Ashtarot v'Atah. So now, Hatzileinu, deliver us miyad oyeveinu, from the hands of our enemies. V'na'avdecha, and we will serve you. Suddenly, they are provoked to remember God, and they pray and they appeal, and precisely because he is all compassionate, by Yishlach Adonai et Yerubal, so the Lord sent Yerubal, that is the judge known as Gideon, et Badan, and we don't really know who Badan is. Tradition says it stands for Ben Dan, the son of Dan. And who was the distinguished son of Dan? Shimshon, Samson. But that's the rabbinic tradition. We had Yiftach, he sent Jephthah, we've met him.
This is the same one we read about before.
Absolutely. We had Shemuel, and he sent me too. Vayatzel etchem miyado yivechem misaviv, and he has saved you from your enemies round about. Vateshu betach, and you have dwelt securely. Reminding them of something here. You are a rotten, ungrateful lot. Yet despite this, God has shown you compassion from the moment you were delivered from Egypt, from the moment you settled in this land. You have done things to annoy him, you have deserted him, and yet he has never failed in the support of you. So when are you going to learn? And the situation now is presenting itself once more. V'ata, and now, and he's led up to this. Hine ha-melech, I'm sorry. V'atiru, ki nachash melech b'nei amon ba'aleichem. Now you saw that Nachash, the king of the Ammonites, came up against you. V'atomru li, and you said to me, lo, we don't want you anymore. We don't want God's rule over us. Ki melech yochaleinu. We want a king, a mortal king, to reign over us. And you did this, Adonai Eloheichem Malkechem, despite the fact that you had a king. The Lord your God was your king. So thank you for your gratitude. I have delivered you, I have saved you, I have forgiven you, I've tolerated you. And when it push comes to shove, you tell me to get lost. By the way, he has indicated something we didn't know before. Remember, at the beginning of their request for a king, they simply come to Samuel and say, you're an old codger now, we want a king. Now Samuel reveals what was really behind it. They were confronted by a very powerful foe, the king of the Ammonites, and they wanted now a different kind of regime to deal with it. You had a perfectly good regime. You couldn't have had a bigger warrior than the guy upstairs. Adonai Ish Milchama, the Lord is a man of war. Look what he did to the Egyptians. So you needed a mortal king to deal with a mortal enemy? You have short-term memories. Nonetheless, God gave you your king. Ve'ata, so now, hine ha-melech asher bechartem, behold the king whom you chose, asher she'eltem, whom you requested, he's here. V'hine natanu na'alech ha-melech, the Lord has given you a king, despite your insult to him. He has granted you your wishes. So now I give you a warning, given your past horrible record. Im tiru et Adonai, if you will indeed fear the Lord, and fear in the sense of you will serve him. So if you will fear the Lord, vavatem oto, and serve him. Ushmatem bokolo, obey him. Velo tamru et pe Adonai, not rebel against the word of the Lord. Notice how He's laying it on with the trowel. Mm. You know, it's like a legal document. I'm covering up all possibilities. And if you, together with your king that now reigns over you, will adhere faithfully to the Lord your God, then all will be well. But if you fail to obey the Lord your God, and you rebel against his word, the hand of the Lord shall be against you and against your fathers. Simple admonition. God help you, because he won't. But the strange word is against your fathers, your ancestors. That's a bit pointless. They're not there anymore.
Against their good name.
Well, against their good name. One suggestion is that as it was against your fathers when they deserved it. But there's a much more simple explanation. Cast your mind back to horrible Micah and his graven image, and the fact that they took no less a personality than Jonathan, the son of Gershon, the grandson of Moses, to be their Levitical priest. God help us. What does Micah say to this young Levite? Please, I want you to be my Av and my Kohen. What, he wanted to adopt him as his daddy? No, Av would mean guide, counselor, leader. That's the basic meaning of the word in this context. So he's warning them, and he does it subtly. The Lord will be against you and your leaders. King, please note. And I think that makes good sense.
Rabotechem.
Yeah.
Leaders.
Yeah, your leaders, but specifically your supreme leader, your commander in chief. Okay. And he continues. Gamata hityatsu. And just to make my point, stand up. Uri'u, and observe et adavar gadol hazeh, the great act asher Adonai oseh le'enechem, which God is about to perform before your eyes. I'm not going to leave it to words, says Samuel. I'm going to make my point much, much more aggressively. Halo ketzichitim ayom. Is it not the wheat harvest today? And please remember, their lives depended upon their harvests. You weren't going to bring stuff in from Europe or from the African continent. You ate what you grew, and if it didn't grow, or if you couldn't eat it, you were in big trouble. And the wheat harvest was one of their major, major sources of food. What did God promise us when you come into the land? V'achalta, you will eat. The ganacha, your corn. Yitzarecha, your oil. Without the wine and your oil and your corn, you're in big trouble. So it's the wheat harvest today. Ekra el Adonai, I'm going to cry out to the Lord. V'yiten kolotu matar, and he's going to send down thunder and rain. The last thing you need when you're about to gather in your harvest is a mighty downpour, because it will ruin your harvest. So please, I'm going to ask for this, udi'u, so I want you to know, udi'u, and to observe, kira'atchem rabah she'asitem b'nei Adonai, that the evil you have done in the eyes of the Lord is overwhelming, lish'ol lachem melech, to ask for a king. Now that seemed to be acting out of pique. You know, you push me out, so now I'm going to teach you all a lesson. Is it? No. We shall see. No. Vayomru kol ha'am el Shmuel. I'm sorry. Vayikra Shmuel el Adonai. And Samuel cried out to the Lord. Vayiten Adonai kol otu matar vayomru. And God sent down on that day out of a clear sky. After all, June in Israel is not noted for cloudy skies. Suddenly out of a cloudy sky, thunder, lightning, rain. Vayira kol ha'am meod at Adonai v'et Shemuel, and the people were terrified of the Lord and of Samuel. And that was the point of the exercise. Samuel knows only too well that part of the inbuilt system of the king was that we should be like the other nations. And we said, a dangerous precedent for a people that are already consulted with paganism. And so he has to get the point across, you've got your king, but remember who is really in charge, God. And remember that I may no longer be your civil military leader, but I am still the prophet of the Lord. And I have the power and authority from God, not from you. You might displace me. In political terms, you cannot displace me. In religious terms, because only the boss man who appointed me can do that. And I'm going to point out to you, and I'm going to prove to you, I still have his mandate. And so he cries out to God, and what does God do? Well, Samuel asked him to do. So they're now terrified, not only of the Lord, but they're afraid of Samuel too. Point well made. Vayomru kol ha'am el Shmuel, and the people said to Samuel, Hitpalel ba'adav adecha el Adonai Elohecha. Please intercede on behalf of your servants before the Lord your God, ba'al namut, and let us not die. And of course, this is the point. They have conceded in their very next breath. Because they don't cry out to God, they cry out to Samuel. We're relying upon you. Because without your intercession, we know we've had it. Ki yasafnu al kol chatoteinu ra'a lishol al melech. Because we now confess that we have added to all our previous evil sins, or rather, we have added evil to all our previous sins, lisholanu melech, by asking for a king. We now confess we were wrong. But it won't change. Having granted them a king, they've got it. And now Samuel calms them, because we still have this feeling that there's a bitterness coming through here. He really wants to make them suffer. Look what he says next. Vayomu Shmuel alam, and Samuel says to the people, Al tira'u, don't be afraid. Now he's like a father, comforting them. Yes, atem esitem kol ha'ra'a hazok, you have indeed done all this evil. Ach! However, al tasuru me'achre Adonai, don't depart from following after the Lord. Don't compound your stupidity. And it's echoing the Shema. Velo tasuru, and you shall not turn aside. Using that same word, because I know what you lot are capable of. Vavavtem Adonai b'chol levavchem, you must serve the Lord with all your heart. Echoing the Shema. Velo tasuru, please don't turn aside, because if you do, it will be useless. If you go courting other gods, waste of time. Ki acharei hatohu ashelo yo'ilu lo yatzilu. You'll only be chasing after nonsense, confusion, that cannot help, that cannot save. Ki tohu yema, because they are emptiness and void. So have the common sense. Have the interests of your own families and children at heart. Don't desert your God. Ki lo yitosh Adonai et amo, because the Lord will never desert his people. Never. We can evaluate this. The Lord will never desert his people. Ba'avur shemo agadol, because of his great name. Ki hoil Adonai la'asot etchem lo la'am, because God consented to make you his people. And this is a profound and phenomenal statement. However bad we may be, even though we cast him off, he'll never cast us off. Even if the love affair will only be one-sided, that love will hold true. And that's precisely what Moses tells them in the book of Devarim. When he says to the children of Israel, It's not because you are the biggest, the most significant and the greatest among the nations that the Lord your God has chosen you. You're an insignificant bunch. You're me'at. You're the least. So why did he choose you? Because he loves you. And a paternal love doesn't have to be rational. A child may not forgive a parent will forgive a child. So he said, if for no other reason, out of common decency, remember your God will never desert you, so don't desert him. And that message, I think, rings down through the ages. And as for me, Gamanochi, as for me, you think I'm acting here out of spite? Chalilali mechatol Adonai. It would be a profanation for me to sin to the Lord, mechadolit valer ba'adchem, by refraining to pray on your behalf, no matter what you've done to me, no matter whatever hurt you've caused me. God forbid I should ever restrain myself from praying on your behalf. Moreover, I will continue to instruct you in the right and proper way. You may not want to listen to me, boys, but I shall be saying it. I still have my job as the prophet of the Lord, and I will continue to do it. And of course, that has an additional underlying threat there too. You see, there is a principle in Jewish law that you cannot be culpable for the full punishment of a crime unless you've first been warned. Ain't onshin elamas hiri. No punishment without admonition. And indeed, strictly according to rabbinic law, you may be aware of this, if A has a gun in his hand and he shoots somebody, he's not guilty of a capital offence. That sounds crazy. No. There have to be two witnesses who has to say to the man, if you pull that trigger, you'll be breaking the law regarding murder and you'll be subject to the death penalty. And he has to answer, even under these circumstances, I'm still going to do it, blow you. And if he then pulls the trigger, he's liable to the full consequences of the law, because we have established premeditation. Not like that in English law, is it? So what Samuel's saying here, at a very much earlier point, I will continue to instruct you, so you will know when you'll be doing wrong, and therefore you'll take the consequences.
It's a bit like dismissing someone, isn't it?
Yeah.
Employment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got to give them notice.
Well, he will. There's only one person to give him notice. Yeah. And he's giving them notice. Ach, yiru et Adonai. And he can't let go of this. Only fear the Lord, because I know what you're like. Vavatem oto, and serve him be'emet in truth, b'chol levavachem, with all your heart. Back to the Shema, back to this implication. Because look, consider the great things he has done for you. But now comes my final warning. But if you persist in doing evil, there will be consequences. You and your king will be swept away. I will not reject the people of Israel, but you lot will get what's coming to you. That's quite a speech, isn't it? Is it the speech of a man who is aching and hurting and wants to hit back? Or is it the speech of a man who still loves and cares for the people who have rejected him? I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Mm. Samuel is a great man. Now, chapter 13, you might have imagined, is the continuation of the narrative. Why not? Next chapter. It isn't. Up till now, how old is Saul? Well, it says Bachur Batov. He's a comely, fine young man.
40 plus?
No, maybe 20 or 30.
Oh.
Yeah. Nowhere near 40. He's still only a young man. Bachur. He's not married yet. Not married yet, presumably. And yet in this chapter we're going to be confronted with Saul's son, who is already a grown-up commander in his own right. So where did he come out of? Mm-hmm. we have to assume that there's a hiatus here. There's quite a gap in time between chapter 12 and chapter 13. And it become immediately apparent. Also, the chapter begins with one of those verses which defies full explanation. I don't use those words lightly. Look what it says. Ben Shana Shaul b'molcho, Saul was 1 year old when he began his reign. Ushtei Shani Malach al Yisrael, and he reigned for 2 years over Israel. Was that some baby? Traditionally, it's understood as when Saul began his reign, he was as innocent as a 1 year old. Only later on, he would improve on that. But of course, that is not implicit in the plain meaning of the text. And the truth of the matter is, it defies any reasonable interpretation as it stands. The author knew what he was saying. I'm sorry that I don't. But look what comes next. Vayivchalo Shaul, Shloshet Alafim b'Yisrael. Saul selects 3,000 men from Israel to be his army. Vayivim Shaul Alpaim Michmash. Saul had 2,000 with him at Michmash. This is going to be his military base. Uvahar Beit El, and in the mount and in the territory of Beit El. Ve'elef hayuim Yonatan, and there were 1,000 with Jonathan. We haven't even been told it's his son. Begivat Binyamin, Gibeah of Benjamin, which was of course Saul's home city. Ve'yetam shilach ish leholav, and as for the rest of the people, he sent them back home. Now, he's going to have a war. So I would have thought, as would happen in modern Israel, you would muster your citizen army. You need a quarter of a million, a half a million fighting men. And he's got 3,000. Why is that? On the one hand, I think it is good policy. You have an agricultural society dependent for its well-being on the land being worked and cared for. Therefore, to absorb your entire manpower standing there waiting for a fight is not good tactic. You send people home to do the essential work on the home front and keep your best men as your warriors. Apart from which, muster too many people at once, you may give your hand away. And also, who says that the people are going to be prepared to come to your muster if you ask them? And I've got good reason for saying that, because look what comes next. It's a strange incident. Jonathan now assassinates the Philistine governor who was stationed at Gibeah. We knew that from before. And the Philistines are dominating the land. They've got an iron grip on the land, and we're using that word intentionally. Jonathan now assassinates him. By Yishmael Plishtim, and the Philistines learn of it, and needless to say, they're not very happy. But Shaul takaba shofar b'chol ha'aretz lemar, and so Saul sounded the shofar, sent out the alarm throughout the whole land of Israel, saying, Yishmael ha'ivrim, let the Hebrews hear it.
So Jonathan killed that man, not part of the war.
You've asked a $64,000 question.
Thank you.
That's the impression you immediately get.
Yeah.
Hot-headed Jonathan has gone ahead and assassinated the Philistine governor. And so now poor old Saul's going to muster an army. By the way, who are the Hebrews? We'll come back to that one. That's a point. I thought the Israelites were the Hebrews, but we'll see. V'chol Yisrael shamu lemor, and the whole of the nation of Israel heard it saying, Hika Shaul et Netziv Plishtim, Saul has assassinated the Philistine governor, v'gam nivash Yisrael b'Plishtim, so that now we are in very bad odour with the Philistines, and with their powerful army, which we shall soon see, they're going to cause us maximum aggro. And so by Yitzhaku Amachare Shaul, the people gather themselves, muster themselves behind Shaul at Gilgal. What has gone on? First reaction to say, well, Jonathan the hothead has dropped his father deep in it. But I don't think so. Saul knew something. You know, Saul shows a lot of sagacity. He wasn't chosen by mere chance. This is a clever man. Unfortunately, he does have a fissure in his personality that will break wide open. But this is a clever man, an able ruler, which is the heartache. And he realizes, the people of Israel, if I send out the muster to come and fight, they won't come. They're too terrified of the Philistines, with good reason. The Philistines are a mighty, powerful fighting force. And if the truth be known, we're not in the same league. So if I say to the people, let's go to war against the Philistines, I may find myself with an army of two, me and Jonathan. So how am I going to get them off their backsides? I have to precipitate it. And how do I precipitate it? By killing the Philistine governor, so that the people will know whether they like it or not, they've got a war on their hands. Maybe up to now we did a Neville Chamberlain, but from this point on, we have to arm.
You see, Jonathan was a sort of commando unit, because he divided, didn't he? He had two-thirds with Saul and one-third with
He gives him 1,000 men in case there's any immediate repercussions for their planned act of assassination.
People say it's Shaul who did it.
Ah, you see, because this is what happened, you know, the Chinese whispering. So they know that somebody has killed Syrian, that Saul has killed the Syrian, the king has killed him. God help us, what's going to happen to us now? That doesn't bother Saul. He's done this as a premeditated act. We've got to get the people to fight. Now let's see what they're up against. Ufilishtim Neesvu, the Philistines got themselves together, Lehilachemim Yisrael, to fight against Israel, Shaloshim Elef Rechev, 30,000 chariots, and they were made of iron.
Cabbage.
Pardon?
30,000 chariots?
Yes. Vesheshet Alafim Parashim, as well as 6,000 cavalry. Ve'am Kachol Asher Al Svat HaYam LaRov, and with foot soldiers, with the rest of his troops, as numerous as the sand on the sea shore. Too numerous to count. I couldn't tell you how many there were. There were too many to count. Boy, is there an army confronting them. And even if this is an exaggeration, even if it is only 3,000 chariots, it would be like sending your cavalry on horses out against Sherman tanks. And I know where I'd put my money. So this is an overwhelming army. Vayalu, and they go up, Vayachanu b'michmash, Kitmat Beit Arvin, and they camp at Michmash, opposite Beit Arvin. Beit Arvin is an anachronism here. The city is called Beit El. That's its name. However, under Jeroboam, the first king of the independent kingdom of Israel, you know, the kingdoms divided, he turned that into his shrine, his temple. Why, we can't discuss now. But he established his temple there, which, okay, he wants to have his own minion. But he then sets up there a golden calf. They were worshipping the God of Israel through a golden calf. And in the fullness of time, having introduced this idolatrous component, they even added other idolatrous components, like a sacred grove where young harlots, both male and female, could serve the worshippers, as was done in the Baal temples. And so in the prophetic world, it was known as not Beit El but Beit Arvin, not the house of God but the house of iniquity. And our author is calling it by that name. It hasn't got there yet. But Beit Arvin or Beit El is, of course, where Jonathan is situated with his troops. So we're now nose to nose. How do the Israelite armies react? The Ish Israel Ra'u, and the men of Israel saw Kitzaru, that they were in big trouble. Ki Nigasa, and the people were being hard pressed. And so Vayitchabu Amba Me'arot V'Chavachim V'Selaim V'Hatzrichim V'Bavrot, and the people who hid themselves in every available nook, cranny, hole, thicket, dugout, you name it. Justifiably dead scared. The Ivrim Avru at Hayarden, and the Ivrim also passed over the Jordan to the Eretz Gad v'Gilad, to the territory of Gad and Gilad. They went back from the west bank to the east bank. They wanted to get out of the way of the Philistine army, and only Shaul Odenu b'Gilgal, Saul is there still in Gilgal, v'chol ha'am chardu acharav, and the people came trembling after him. Once again, I know where I put my money. Who are the Ivrim? Hebrews, they're the Israelites. You can see from this text they're not.
Okay.
I'm talking about the Israelites and the Hebrews.
Mm. Are they the Yehuda?
No. First of all, who is the first Hebrew?
Abraham.
Abraham HaIvri. He is the first Hebrew. Why was he called Abraham HaIvri? Because his daddy was a Hebrew. No.
Because he crossed the...
Absolutely. The word Ivri is a derivative of the expression Avar, to pass over. And Abraham was one of a whole group of people who in the 3rd millennium, 2nd millennium BCE, were moving out of Mesopotamia. He came from the deep south. Mm-hmm. He's a southern boy from Shumer. Out of Mesopotamia, through the Fertile Crescent. Are you familiar with the Fertile Crescent? Picture the map. Iraq, through Syria, down into Canaan, onto Egypt. And there's your cradle of civilization. And nomadic merchants were constantly on the move. Nomads still are moving around that way. But that goes back thousands of years. So if you came from beyond the river Euphrates, you're an Ivri. Now, this term was, of course, applied not only to one man or one people. It must have been used for a whole group of such peoples. Indeed, it may have been used, more specifically, for the descendants of Abraham. Because, remember, the Israelites were not the only descendants of Abraham. Abraham had a son called Ishmael, and then there was Esau with the Edomite. There may have been a group of peoples claiming their descent from Abraham the Hebrew who could be collectively described as Hebrews and who would have had a common interest in getting the Philistines off their neck. And so when he does go to war against the Philistines, Saul says, Hebrews, join in our common cause. And now, of course, the 30,000 Sherman tanks have turned up on the scene. The Hebrews are taking themselves out of reach. And there's poor old Saul left there with a skeleton army. But it'll get worse. Vayochel Shivat Yamim Lamoeda Sheshmuel. And he waited the 7 days which Samuel told him to wait. Samuel said, I'll meet you in Gilgal. 7 days. Why? Because before you go into battle, you've got to offer up sacrifices to entreat God to be on your side. This was an essential prerequisite to my battle. Without it, I'm doomed. And he waits. V'lovashmu el Gilgal, and Samuel didn't turn up. Now, that's not very nice. Why isn't he there? So, what does Saul do in his desperation? And it is desperate. Because v'yafetz ha'am me'alav, the people start deserting him. So he's sitting there in Gilgal, knowing he's going to go into a battle, desperate to plead to God, and the people who are waiting for this act are saying, whoa, no Samuel, no intercession with God, I think someone needs me at home. By Yom HaShaul, and so Saul in his desperation says, Hagishu Eleiha Olav HaShlamim, fetch on the sacrifices and the peace offerings, by Yalola, and he offers it up. And I would argue he has a right. He is the anointed of the Lord. He has the sanctity of a priest. And guess what? By Hikachaloto La Alota Ola, the moment he finished offering up the offerings, Vinei Shemuel Ba, Samuel turns up. Do you find that a little bit suspicious? And Saul goes out to greet him and to bless him, and he doesn't get much of a hello from Samuel. And Samuel says to him, Me'asita, what have you done? And Saul said, I saw the people were deserting me, and you didn't come when you said you would. And look over the brow there, the Philistines already gathered against me at Michmash. So I said to myself, Gilgal, the Philistines at any minute will descend upon me at Gilgal. And I haven't even entreated God. Therefore, for Etapach, I had to force myself. I didn't want to do it. I offered up the sacrifice. Does that seem to be a reasoned argument to you?
No.
I wouldn't have done any different in his shoes. But Samuel says to Saul, Niskalta, you have behaved foolishly. Lo shamartait mitzvat Adonai Elohecha, you have not observed the commandment of the Lord your God, asher tzivach, which he specifically gave you. Had you done so, ki ata heichin Adonai et mamlachtecha el Yisrael adulam, God would have established your monarchy, your dynasty over Israel in perpetuity. Now that's a turn up for the books, because we know that aboriginally, to which tribe was monarchy promised? Tribe of Judah, to be eventually taken up by David. And here he's saying, if you'd obeyed God, forget Judah, you would have been the founder of Israel's monarchy. But now, Mamlachtecha lo takum, your kingship will not survive, will not endure. Bikesh Adonai lo ishkil vavo, God has already sought a man after his own heart. And God has appointed him as the prince over his people. Because you haven't observed what God commanded you to do. And with that, Vayakom Shmuel, Samuel got up, Vayal mina Gilgal, and departed from Gilgal, Givat Binyamin, to the Gibeah of Benjamin, leaving Saul there deserted on his own. And just when you thought it couldn't get worse, by Yifkal Shaul et Ha'am HaNimtzi Mamo, Saul musters the people, numbers the people who are with him, Kashesh Meod Ish, and he has about 600 men. How bad could it get? Look what's happened to him. He's confronted an army vastly superior, desperately in need of Samuel's support, desperately in need of divine approval. Samuel doesn't come. He has to intercede. And when he does come, he's given the glad tidings, you failed to obey God, you've had it. So with my 600 men, I'm going out against 30,000 chariots, knowing that God isn't even on my side anymore. I'm doomed. Now you know why I call Saul a tragic figure. Big time. Because what has he done wrong? If you weigh up each one of his actions, I wouldn't have done anything different. I think he behaved responsibly. So how are we going to account for Samuel's attitude? Pique? Annoyance? Rubbing his belly at the fact that Saul's getting his comeuppance? No.
Lack of faith.
That is the crucial issue. To be a servant of the God of Israel, either as a prophet or as a king, what is the absolute prerequisite? An unquestioning trust in God.
I suppose it's debatable whether he actually put himself in that position.
Well, it's true. But then again, David was not put, didn't put himself in that position. But when he is confronted by total eradication by his own beloved son Absalom, and the priests say, look, you're going, leaving Jerusalem, take the trump card with you. Take the Ark of the Covenant. That would be a rallying point for the people of Israel. And Samuel says, put it back in Jerusalem, I'm not taking it. What the Lord wants, he will do. If it is his will that I will come back and behold it again, I will do so. Adonai hu, he is the Lord. Atol v'einav yaseh, he does what is good in his eyes. That's faith. Saul is in an impossible position. And yet, even in that impossible position, he should have said, Lord, I trust in you. Now see me through it. So he lacked the essential component. It's harsh, it's hard, and I still feel sorry for Saul. And before we're finished, we'll feel a lot more sorry for Saul. You know, he's the finest monarch maybe we never had. But let the story unfold. For Shaul, for Jonathan, but no, and Saul, and Solomon, and Jonathan his son, for Aman Nimsahimam, and the people who were found with them, Yoshim Begeba Binyamin, was stationed in Gibeah of Benjamin, or Flishtim Chanuba Michmash, and over the brow of the ridge there you've got the Philistines camping Mishma. Well, with an army so great, guess who's going to make the first move? And the destroyers, the storm troops, set out from the Philistine position in three groups. They're going to attack in three different places against an army of 600. Harosh, Rosh Echan, Yifnei Oderech Afra. The one group set out for Ofra, El Eret Shaul, to the land of Shual. Varosh Echad, Yifnei Oderech Beit Choron. The second group set out for Beit Horon, Varosh Echad, Yifneh Derech HaGavul. Then the remaining group set out towards the boundary, Hanishkaf Algei HaTzvoim, Hamibarah, which overlooked the valley of Tzvoim, towards the wilderness. They've dissipated, they've got the Israelites having to focus on three fronts. And now we're going to learn the sad truth. I mentioned more than once that the age of Saul is the Bronze Age. In fact, it is the final phase of the Bronze Age. It's Homeric Troy and Saul in that era. But the smelting of iron and the use of iron had already begun. Iron tools, iron implements were already being manufactured. Notably in Anatolia, in Asia Minor, by the Hittites. And in the Aegean, by the Cretans. They were making iron weapons, iron tools. Now, that second piece of information is vital for us. Where did the Philistines come from, Mummy? Where did the Philistines come from?
From Crete,
from Kaftor. Mm-hmm. And they came and settled on the coastland of Canaan, bringing their advanced technology with them.
So they came before?
Oh, yeah.
Before, long before.
How long, I do not know. There's evidence of the of these people being there, 12th, 13th century, already crossing the Egyptians' path and making their presence felt, because the Egyptians also had bronze weapons. Iron weapons are vastly superior. So I have a nation with advanced technology facing a people with nothing. With nothing. Why? You see, the Philistines are more than happy to sell implements to the Israelites, but in no way would they let on their technology for making iron implements, for smelting iron. Not only that, they didn't allow them something equally important to maintain their implements. You can't have implements, you've got to have servicing. So look at next. V'charash lo yimatze b'chol eretz Yisrael. Not a single smith was to be found in the whole of Israel. The Philistines saw to that. Ki amru plishtim, because the Philistines said, pen yaso evrim cherebol chanit, just in case the Israelites start manufacturing their own swords and spears, we're taking away from them their capacity to arm themselves. Vayeru chol ish, chol Yisrael haplishtim, so that every Israelite had to go down to the Philistines, Lutosh ish et macharashto, et eito, et kaldumo, et macharashto, in order to have his plowshares, mattocks, axes and sickles, all his essential farming equipment sharpened. They couldn't do it for themselves. They're totally dependent upon the Philistine technology. And not only are they dependent, they've got to pay through the nose for it. And the cost for sharpening was a pim. This word occurs nowhere else to hold the Bible. So how much is a pim? From archaeological discoveries in several places, they have found little stone weights with the word pim on it. And it's approximately 2/3 of a shekel.
Mm-hmm. And one M.
Well, yeah. Yes, it's like the old-fashioned medieval mark, which was 2/3 of a pound. Okay. So they had to pay למחרישות, ולעיתים, ולשלוש קילושון, וכרדומים, ולהציל הדורם. And they had to pay for the sharpening of all their instruments and for the resetting of their goads, everything. They had to pay for it. So, והיה ביום מלחמת, it transpired therefore on the day that they were going out to battle, ולא נמצא חרב וחנית ביד כל העם אשר את שאול ואת יונתן. Not a single sword or spear was to be found for any of the men going out to battle with Jonathan, Saul and Jonathan his son. ותימצא לשאול וליונתן בנו. However, they were able to find a sword for Saul and for Jonathan his son. They are the only two armed men in an army of 600 facing the massed might of the Philistines. And Vayetse Matzah Philistim El Mava Michmash, the Philistines now advance to Michmash, to the Michmash Pass, to do battle. That's the point at which we're going to stop. I'm going to make sure you come back next term to find out what's going on. Pardon?
Dramatic point to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're almost welcome.
Maybe 7 the first day. Yeah.
So, question,
please do.
You mentioned about the world to come.
Yes.
The Torah is the basis of our religion.
Yes.
Nowhere in the five books of Moses does it mention the world to come.
Well, that is a subject of dispute, I have to say. That is a subject of dispute. If I could have the text back, unless somebody wants to keep a text, but otherwise. You see, Abraham, is told that you will come to your fathers in peace. Now, where are they? It means he's going down into the grave, or he's going to join his ancestors in a better place. Number two, in a society which implicitly believed in a life beyond death. Indeed, the major culture of that region of that age were the Egyptians. Look how much manpower the Egyptians spent and how much wealth they invested in preparing for the afterlife. Mm. Mm. If you don't believe me, go and have a look at that little place called the Pyramid. and build it today. And what was it built for? The afterlife of the Pharaoh. So I find it very difficult to believe that the Israelites have emerged from that kind of environment and they don't believe in an afterlife. If you'll ask me, is the biblical concept of the afterlife identical with the rabbinic concept, then I would have to say, not proven. Give you an honest answer. Not proven. Will that suffice? It may not satisfy you, but will that suffice?
It'll do for the time.
Yes. It has to do for me as well.